The following is Noreen Wiesel's talk, The Information Architecture of Emergency Response, from the 2012 Information Architecture Summit. The 2012 IA Summit podcasts are brought to you by User Interface Engineering and the UIE Virtual Seminar Program. Stay tuned after the podcast for a special offer from UIE.
Good morning, everyone. It's 10:30. I guess we can start. My name is Noreen Wiesel, and you probably know me, some of you, as the Operations Manager at the Information Architecture Institute. I'm also a freelance researcher, designer, geographer, and one of the projects that I'm working on is something that I'm going to be talking about today, which is emergency response systems in New York City. I thought that it was pretty fitting that we were having such a violent storm last night because one of the main responses that the city deals with and that most emergency management offices deal with are weather events. So let's start. Just an overview, one of the things that got me interested in this is I've been a participant in a geographic information systems organization in New York City called GISMO for 20 years. And they are basically people who are interested in geographic information systems, and a lot of the members are agency members, people who work for the City of New York in lots of different departments, as well as vendors and engineering companies, real estate people, lawyers. You know, I was a real estate analyst at Pricewaterhouse when I first started. But one of the things that we did as an organization is we decided that the 10-year anniversary was an ideal time to talk about the technology advances in emergency response since 9/11. So we're going to talk a little bit about what's been going on in New York City, a little bit about open government and public engagement, and what kinds of things are out there in the future that the emergency management community is going to need from people like us, because there's a lot of convergence with geography and the kinds of applications that we're developing. And then in the end, hopefully we'll have time to talk a little bit about what's going on in your communities and ideas that you might have for new kinds of applications. So we'll start here. We're at the Hyatt Regency. This is actually the building that was standing here during Hurricane Katrina, which was destroyed. And that was another reason that I thought that this would be a great venue to propose this event, because this is a place that has been a seat of a lot of tragedy. So there were a lot of services that were disrupted, obviously, because the city was inundated and there was a lot of disorganization. And out of things like this and the 9/11 events, it became an imperative to coordinate response across agencies, communicate, open up data, you know, have your data be interoperable so that we don't have this kind of situation where people are completely trapped and stranded. This is Ground Zero in New York City. And unfortunately, during the attacks on the World Trade Center, the Emergency Management Office, which had been developed in direct response to the first attack on the Trade Center, which was in 1993, opened in 7 World Trade Center. So all of the backup systems, all of the information about where the shelters would be, where the information is about infrastructure, was located in one of these buildings and also in another building that was very close by and had to be evacuated. So there was this big community response, particularly through the Gizmo group that I was with, to get people who had access to data and understand how to present it and get the information to the first responders. So we're going to talk about who these first responders are. Sometimes they're us. We help each other get through situations when there isn't a lot of, you know. I just added this slide, so I wanted to just talk about the kinds of things that were available at 7 World Trade Center that needed to be made redundant in other locations. It became a turning point. One thing that happened was I was one of the recruiters for the people who came out to help at Pier 92, which became kind of a temporary emergency operations center for the city. And there was a lot of, you know, infighting to improve the data flow between agencies so that everybody had the information that they needed to get. There were a lot of processes and hierarchies within agencies that didn't really talk with other agencies. So one of the things that the Emergency Operations Center and the Emergency Management Office in New York City was trying to do is develop systems that will allow these systems to talk to each other and data to mesh up with each other. So for the GeoSymposium, which was the 10-year retrospective, I did a poster, which is going to be at the poster session tonight, on changes in technology over time. And I basically have divided the period into 4 distinct periods where I found that there was an increase in this cooperation between agencies and understanding of how the databases are supposed to talk to each other, as well as new public initiatives that opened up as data access became more open. So we'll talk a little bit about policy later as well. And this is the other half of it. It's basically a lot of the incidents that the Office of Emergency Management responded to during this period, starting with the baseline in 2001. Actually, I have another incident here that was a little bit before that, which was the ground zero of the H1N1 flu virus in New York City, which actually was ground zero in the United States as well. So what is an emergency response system? Common elements of the emergency response system, obviously, if there are people who are involved in responding to the event, reporting the event, and doing back-end systems, analyzing data to prevent events. There are measurements and tools and devices, data and information systems, communications and communication systems, and then the response themselves. And there are touch points within all of these areas that we as a design community might be involved in developing. This is very typical, what we think of when we think of an emergency response. A fire happens, the fire people come and they make sure that everything's okay. Sometimes it's a real fire, sometimes it's just a false alarm. There's a lot of communication that happens. There's the 911 dispatch services. Then, of course, a lot of report writing. And then an investigation and maybe some preventative stuff to make sure that this doesn't happen. Emergency response system can be very detailed. This is a national level, national incident management system, and it's basically a diagram of how the different national level offices integrate and communicate with local level offices when there is a local event. But it can also be very, you know, small events. It could be a mother and her baby who's worried about a fever. So this is also an emergency response system. Again, you have people, you have tools, you have data, you have a response. So the first thing that I wanted to talk about was the people. And again, it could be a very small thing. I cut my finger in the kitchen when I'm cooking. That's an emergency. I'm the person who takes care of myself. I could also be the person who witnesses a response, and then somebody comes, you know, and puts out the fire or responds to a call about a theft. And then we also have these emergency management systems that allow the communication between all of the actions and people who are involved in an event. And I could also be that person who has the thermometer checking my baby's temperature. But it could also be this system that I presented before that's this huge national coordination. A mental model that most people might have for an emergency event is that something bad happens, somebody calls for help, emergency responder arrives, and aid is given, then you fill out a lot of forms. Basically, this is what's really happening. There's a lot of preparation before something even happens. Policies, there are drills and simulations, particularly for very large events like a hurricane. How do you coordinate these kinds of responses? And even in New York City, there's concerns about hazardous materials and possible criminal activity. So they have these really large coordinated responses to address these things. And again, forms, maps, communication, there are tools that run through every single step of the way. So it's not just at the end when you're filling out your insurance form. It's not just in the end when the police report is being written up. There's stuff going on all through it. And our community is all going to have, you know, opportunities in these areas. Emergency management in New York City. I've been visiting the emergency management office a lot recently because of the geosymposium that I helped to develop with them. It's a very, very interesting operation. They have a lot of people who work in policy and planning most of the time. And there are teams of people who are on call for emergency events. I think there's three teams, a red, white, and blue team, that are on call 3 weeks on and 6 weeks off in case an event happens. And there's a huge emergency operations center that's about maybe three times as large as this room that's only called and only opened when there is an event to respond to. And most of the events lately that they've responded to have been weather events, but there are also other events like pipes that break and, you know, there was a steam pipe explosion in Midtown a couple of years ago, and there, you know, are obviously other things that happen. When the UN has a lot of dignitaries in, they'll open up the emergency management center. So what they do is they plan and prepare for emergencies, they educate the public. I've got a lot of materials of some of the things that they produce for educating the public about preparedness. And they also disseminate information, and a lot of it's open data. You can download information about events that have happened. This is what the Emergency Operations Center looks like. It's been described as kind of like a Star Trek room. And all of these workstations are generally external agencies. So you have your medical, your emergency management, your safety, your utilities, regional responders, and national like FEMA. which is the Federal Emergency Management Agency. The National Weather Service has a permanent seat there as well. And then in this big oval in the middle, there's emergency management staff who are in charge of communicating what's coming in from these different sectors and then reporting to the command team so that the people on the ground could get the information that they need. There's a watch command center that is operational 24/7, which is at one end of the room behind a glass wall, and they have video streams of events, of news, weather, other kinds of events that are happening on the street, and they're monitoring that and putting out reports for the public. The fire department has their own emergency operations center, and I wanted to just give a picture of that as well, which is also operational 24/7. This is a floor plan, and as I said before, utilities, infrastructure, private sector, all of these different agencies are working together and gathering information during an event and reporting it to the OEM staff, who also delivers data to the GIS team, which is the Geographic Information Systems team that creates maps that go out to the first responders. The National Incident Management System is something that was created by FEMA and the Department of Homeland Security, and they've mandated that local emergency response teams also must comply so that when data is shared, it can be accessible and shareable through other agencies and regional agencies that might have to be called in for a response. So it complies with the New York City Citywide Incident Management System complies with that system and is compatible. It's basically a framework. It's not really an information system. It's basically it defines the roles and responsibilities and chains of command, common processes and vocabularies so that data can be interoperable between agencies. And it also allows for continuity of operations because there's a lot of redundancy requirements so that if you lose access to a connection to your data, there are other ways that you can get access to it either through a regional partner or through other agencies within the system. Some of the emergency response technologies during an event, maps and imaging, that's my area. So you're gonna see a lot of maps. Sensors, and a lot of these are handheld sensors, you know, breathalyzer that the police have when they're checking DUIs is one example. Fingerprint sensors and other kinds of sensors. Communication devices, information systems, and vehicles. And I like the vehicles. I've got a lot of information about the vehicles that I'm gonna be presenting during the poster session, but they're really cool. So New York City has a base map that they've been developing since the 1990s, which that's one of the things that made it difficult to coordinate response early on, is that each agency seemed to have their own maps that they worked from. A lot of these were hand-drawn maps from a long time ago. And they didn't always line up with census data for streets and roads or with building infrastructure data from the Department of Buildings. So in the 1990s, there was a lot of work that was done just putting the maps so that they fit the data, so that there's a common map that everybody can work from. There are a lot of maps that I'm going to show you. There's also LIDAR imaging and thermal imaging, which give a better view of what's going on in a situation, and aerial and satellite imagery as well. The GIS office in the Department of Information Technology, Telecommunications, and Information Technology does a lot of things. They're creating the web map framework for publicly presenting these city maps. And they've also got a lot of these other things that I can talk about at the poster session later on. But the idea is to really create these common base map systems so that people can communicate and their data can layer properly. Back in the 90s, city mapping departments were siloed. A lot of people weren't sharing data. Some of it was because of legal constraints. You would write a contract for software for engineering services with one vendor, and you would not be able to share it legally with other agencies. And so one of the things that the city's been trying to do is make it so that when we write these contracts, we're actually able to share a little bit more. So that was one of the largest constraints in sharing data. By 1999, there was a unified base map, largely through the advocacy efforts of Gizmo. And 9/11, as I said before, drove home the need for a uniform base map. Early base maps, as I said, weren't always lined up. They didn't always show, you know, what was actually in reality. You can see some of these lines didn't match up with the edges of the East River in this particular image. One of the things that I was working on in the early 2000s was, because there was still a lot of political and, you know, siloing going on in the agencies, is that Municipal Art Society is an organization that decided to work with local, I guess it's called the New York Public Interest Research Group, to develop a tool that local community boards can use to really understand the power of mapping, and also to pilot this idea that the city should take on providing these kinds of tools to the public, or at least to the local community boards. So I worked on this with the Municipal Arts Society, going into a couple of pilot community boards, facilitating some trainings, doing some formal testing to find out what can they use, what do they understand, and what kinds of layers of data do they want to have access to, with the idea that the city should have this stuff public so that people can get access to the data. And they did. It was launched and offered to the city agencies in 2000 and then launched publicly in 2001 with neighborhood statistics, essentially. And then in 2004, they debuted a map portal that had a lot more data that you can layer on, including things like zoning, community board districts and other political boundaries, map building information so that you can find out about owners and building violations and things like that. And then they've gone through different iterations where they've released new themes. This is an example of one of the things that you can do with these maps now. What I did on this, and I can do a live demo, hopefully I'm going to try to do some live demos during the poster session, but what I did here is I layered over the transportation routes of commercial traffic with bike routes. And what you can do here is you can see where there are some possible overlaps of bikers and transportation. And they did actually use this to design bike routes that didn't overlap with the more heavy traffic. And then you can also use it to find out when traffic might be heavier on those routes where the bikes do go on the same routes with the trucks. So there's a lot of planning that this can be used for. And then since then, they've launched a whole bunch of different mapping themes around different things like parks, which restaurants have rats, searchable property and environmental is basically property data, street closures, and zoning. So you can basically take the map and look at different themes so that you have information about the areas that you're interested in. This is an example of a zoning map. This is a new, couple years old. It's a Target and a Costco in East Harlem. And it shows the building footprint and a lot of the information about the owners and size and things like that. And then this is a layer that I added on top of it, which shows the zoning and the land uses in the neighborhood. So you can actually use it for development as well as, you know, finding out how to get there and traffic patterns and things like that. And then I also wanted to show a comparison because we're all familiar with Google. Google Map also provides themes that are related to just general getting around and finding places and seeing what the weather is. And these are really useful, but I also wanted to show the power of some of these other maps that the city's developed. LIDAR, which is light detection and ranging, these were first utilized in New York City for the rescue and recovery of the World Trade Center. And what this could do, which was really innovative, is that it could actually see through smoke. So you can get a really good idea of the topography of the buildings without anything obscuring. It was really a very powerful tool. And also thermal imaging, you can see where the fires were burning, how long they were burning, whether it was spreading. That would also give you an indication of structural integrity of the various buildings that were being investigated. Another thing that they're using is oblique angle aerial photography. And the fire department uses this a lot to kind of look at before and after images so that they can see what structures look like from different sides and then kind of predict what's going on if there's smoke and they need to respond to that. The hurricane evacuation zone finder was something that was really popular during Irene. I don't actually live in an area that needed to be evacuated, but this was really useful because it gives you not only information about which neighborhoods would need to be evacuated, but also where the evacuation centers are. So if you needed to get temporary housing, you knew where to find it. Sensors. This is another area, another tool in emergency response. There are a lot of handheld GPS devices. They were used in 9/11 to geolocate items that were found in the rubble so that they could have a database of where everything ended up. So this was everything from human remains to cell phones and personal effects, and they used that to really, you know, find out what happened and where everything was. They also use seismographic activity, thermal readings, lots of different things. Dogs are great sensors. You can't really design a product for a dog, but they can find chemical traces. They're used to find out if there might be human survivors. Also, your eyes and your ears are very important sensors. communications. Anybody ever have one of these? This is a 2001 era BlackBerry, and it actually was one of the only ways that people could communicate with one another. So when we're talking about having systems that are redundant and able to allow us to communicate with one another, during 9/11, the landlines were down and the cell phones were working in the beginning, but then they got overloaded pretty quickly. But the BlackBerry was actually the only thing that was consistently open and usable. Some of the other communications through the Office of Emergency Management, the wireless network, which allows people out in squad cars and in the field vehicles to communicate with the databases. These other things are kind of obvious. There's also printed information. I've got a lot of these ready, emergency plans for various things like what to do with your pets or with the elderly. And then the Emergency Communications Transformation Program, which was also a way to update 911 to be more interoperable. So New York City wireless network, one of the things that's going on right now is it's a very expensive thing to integrate. And I'd read recently that they're actually trying to renegotiate the maintenance contract, or maybe they've completed that with the provider, which was Northrop Grumman. But it's a pretty powerful system, and it allows you to get access to information from the field. The CBRN, that's chemical, biological, radiation, nuclear sensors. There's actually some integration with the database through that. They do live streaming of video so that you can see what's happening live at an event, and it can be streamed back to the mayor's office or to other mobile command units. And it also allows you to do on-site medical things. So if somebody is suffering from exposure to some kind of chemical, you would be able to use this network to contact medical personnel to find out, what do I need to do? And this is very useful for the first responders, again, your fire, EMS, police. Public initiatives, I just mentioned the Ready New York Guides. The 311 call center is also something that was very useful, obviously, for getting information out to people who have concerns that are not emergency related. It streamlined a lot of that by allowing a ticketing system so people could put in a ticket for an incident that's a question that they have where they need to get information from agencies. And this is a bunch of information that came out of a report from last year about the 311. They have a lot of different channels that they offer information and ways to put in questions through Twitter and to get information. Notify New York City is another channel that the Emergency Management Office uses, where they present information via Twitter and RSS and email, and it can be localized. You can ask it to only give you information about stuff that's going on in your local area, such as your borough or your community board. We get everything from messages about weather events, train disruptions, amber alerts and silver alerts. Those are when there's a missing child or a missing elderly person. And there's a notification also that can go into taxis and electronic road signs for events that might be, you know, causing disruptions. And then it also has an emergency alert system that can broadcast over television and radio. And these are monitored 24/7 by watch commanders in the emergency management offices. And here's one. And this is kind of what they look like. These are all the different categories of notifications that are covered by this system. So public school closing, beach closings, structural collapses, and things like that, tornadoes, weather events. Some of the other channels that New York City Notify uses is Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube, so that they can get more detailed information. So if there's a lot of concern around an event that's happening, they can provide updated information to the public this way. Enhance 911 streamlines emergency call taking. This is something that they've been working on for a number of years in just really getting the systems interoperable, because the 911 system, police, fire, and EMS had separate systems, and it was something that they really needed to develop to get them to improve their response capabilities, because they would have their systems set up so that they were interoperable. Information systems is the next category of components of a response system. And there are a number of information systems, including the assets and logistics. That's how to find, you know, where the trucks and backhoes and, you know, equipment that you need to clear up an area if there's a collapse, and other systems for improving situational awareness and field response. So this is a listing of the kinds of things that would be in the asset and logistics system: fleets, facilities, contracts, personnel, donated goods. It helps to coordinate these items and get them, you know, to the places where they need to go, because you know who to call to get it. The medical examiner's office has a victim identification system that they've been building modules for since 2004, and it's also integrated with 311. Because when an event happens, such as a building collapse, people might be concerned that their family members or people that they're concerned about might have been involved. So they call 311 to do a missing persons report, and they can actually check against things like hospital admission reports and airplane manifests if there's a crash and other things like that. This is another thing that was developed very recently. And basically what it is it's a really big screen in the watch commander's office that has live information about incidents that are currently happening so that they can coordinate where the teams need to go. And then the last component was vehicles. I like these vehicles. They're a lot of fun. The first one, the Interagency Command Center, was put into service in, I believe, 1999 or 1997. I've got a slide on that, but I don't have the number here. Basically what it is it's a mobile command center. So they can set up meetings in there. They've got the full wireless system set up in there. And then in 2003, they added a mobile data center, and that's actually a GIS center. So you can do mapping live in the field through the wireless connection with the city. And then the little one on the lower left-hand corner is the Interagency Communications Vehicle, and this resembles a lot TV crew vans. They've got the communication systems equipment in there, and they can communicate on lots of different channels and different frequencies and different kinds of communication systems. And then the newest one, which was introduced in 2009, is the Mobile SIN Center, and that's basically the Citywide Incident Management System Center. And this is a really huge van. It can expand to 20 feet wide. You can have 40 people in there, a number of computer stations. It basically becomes your mobile emergency operations center. The Mobile Data Center, which was introduced in 2003, which has the GIS capabilities, this is just a diagram of how it accesses the information back at the headquarters and gets the information out to the field responders. So how do all of these different systems work together? I picked a case study, the Hudson River Parkway wall collapse. It's something that happened in 2005, where a 300-foot section of wall slid into the northbound lane of the Henry Hudson Parkway. This is a pretty huge event. Disrupted traffic for several days because they needed to monitor the structural integrity of some of the other walls that were in the neighborhoods next to it because they were concerned that they might fall. And also on some of these walls, this particular section didn't have any housing on top of it, but there were other sections of the walls that have housing that go right up to the edge of the street. So you had people from the Parks Department that had to come in and remove the trees. You had people from Fire Department and EMS. Luckily, there were actually no drivers on the road when this happened, so nobody was hurt in this case. But it could have been a big deal. They also contacted the Columbia University's Lamont Doherty Earth Center to get seismographic readings to find out whether an earthquake caused it or whether it was just the structural integrity of the wall, and they decided that's what it was. The wall just was old, and it wasn't reinforced properly. So then there was a lot of the mitigation. Okay, so what do we do now to make sure that these walls won't fall down? And they've put in sensors. I think there are 60 sensors along a few miles of the wall to monitor it and make sure that it's not going to happen. Or if it is about to happen, that there will be crews there, you know, ready to mitigate that as well. So back to the elements of a response. You had people. The victims in this case weren't people who were injured. They were basically people who were displaced from the surrounding apartments because they were concerned that there might have been some structural problems in the systems under the street that feed into the building. So they wanted to make sure that gas lines and water lines and those kinds of things were repaired or at least stable so that people could go back into their homes. Again, I mentioned seismographic sensors. They also used thermal and satellite imaging to see where the wall was and how it might have shifted, search dogs to find out if there were any people who were buried and there weren't. Data and information systems included the GIS, infrastructure maps, the ortho aerial photography. Communications are radio communications, public, you know, information, briefings with the mayor and one of the larger interagency command centers, the mobile command center. And of course, the response. Now I'm going to move a little bit away from emergency and talk about open government. And one of the things that I was interested in was the information policy of mayors as we move from what you would think of as a law enforcement mayor.
Before you change topics, I'd like to ask a quick question about the emergency response and the systems. What you've shown us is all New York City-centric.
Right.
How compatible is that with
The National Incident Management System that's developed by the Department of Homeland Security and FEMA actually mandates that the local emergency management teams work toward interoperability with regional emergency teams. So it varies because it's not completely interoperable, but they're mandated to get as close as they can to interoperability with local and regional. It's part of, yeah. Okay. I looked a little bit into the history of information policy over the last 10 and then 15, 20 years. Between what you would think of as a law enforcement mayor and somebody who has a background in information, he owns Bloomberg, which has the terminal, which has the news and financial information. One of the things that I found is that a lot of the difference in the policy is the availability of data, the availability of data that can be downloaded and that can be used, the bandwidth that allows us to use GIS and mapping. The internet was not available in the 1990s. The technology wasn't up to it. During that period when Giuliani was a mayor, I was a real estate analyst at Pricewaterhouse, and I don't really remember not getting access to the data that I needed from the city. So I don't know that there was generally a policy, although you'll hear concerns about data openness from civic interest groups who felt that the administration may have been blocking access to information. There were reports that in order to get general information that was typically available, you started to have to use Freedom of Information Law requests, which was basically a hurdle to get the data. But I didn't really see that myself when I was doing real estate. Giuliani was developing an open discussion of issues that were going on. He promoted kind of Clinton-style town hall meetings and, you know, talkbacks and things like that more frequently than his predecessors, I guess. But again, you know, it all kind of goes back to information sharing, data formats. Is the format interoperable? Are there licensing restrictions that make it difficult to get the information? There were discussions happening that were really promoting opening up data during that time. Bloomberg's information policy, I don't know if anybody's up on what's going on in New York City right now, is there's a mandate that all information coming out of agencies has to be available to the public and open. One of the reasons that this is of interest to this administration is because it's kind of a bad economic time. There really isn't a lot of money to create applications that are useful for citizens, and there's a lot of data. So why not open this up and allow the developer community to put together applications that might be useful? And since 2009, the Bloomberg administration has hosted something called the Big Apps Contest, which provides data sets to the public and gets them to put together an application and gives them money for the winners. And then there are also other hackathons and other kind of open data programs. Change by Us is a program where you submit ideas and then hackers or developers will do applications that utilize the data and provide a service. There's a roadmap that was about a year old just last week for the digital city, which outlines the information about open government and public engagement. And it's all very positive. One of the things that I was a little concerned about is exactly what open data means and how far toward developing services that are really needed versus services that are kind of cool and interesting. How far this actually allows you to do that. But I've become less skeptical over time because I've seen that the Department of Information Technology and Telecommunications has really been trying to get more people to develop useful applications and not just where you should eat or where the bathrooms are in New York City. There are open data initiatives that are supported by cloud services like Socrata and a number of different organizations. Municipality of New York City is now on board with that. This is their open data website where you can download the data sets. And I also wanted to compare it to some of the things that are going on around the world in terms of how you can use open data and crowdsourcing. Google Crisis Maps is an open emergency management system. And it looks like I'm running out of time. I just wanted to go through a few of these. I did a survey of people who are in the GIS community and in the agencies to find out what our community can do to help them. And I'd like to invite you all to come down to my poster session to talk about these things. One of the things that comes up the most is ease of use and accuracy of data. incompatibility with legacy systems. So this is all the vocabularies, this is all ways to exchange information and get the systems to talk to one another and then get the data out to the people on the ground and the emergency response teams in a useful fashion so that they can make really quick decisions. So we talked a little bit about requirements and delivery gaps, and again, it keeps coming up. Simplicity, redundancy, and coverage. Not a lot of people actually employ information architects as a title, but they are aware that they need that skill set. So just wanted to promote that as a way for some of you to, if you're interested in this area, that there is an interest in getting the kinds of services that we provide. I'm going to skip ahead to some of the specific ideas that the Emergency Management Office is interested in getting from our community. A lot of visualization, they're starting to work in 3D data, which is a brand new thing for analyzing infrastructure systems, crowdsource data, ways of doing field data collection and communication, so that's going to be your handheld applications. And then just generally, what are some of the ways that we can access and share data in real time so that we have a common picture and a common operating picture of what's going on? Another concern is also managing expectations. A lot of times the public might have expectations about the kinds of data that's available and the kinds of ways that they can use it. So you need to make sure that your data formats work, that when you're using particular vocabulary, that people understand what you're talking about between one agency and the next, and whether you're actually prepared for the cost of things like data security and maintenance. And do your users have, you know, an idea of appropriate use of different systems? So if the OEM has, or if the fire department has a Facebook page, are people actually trying to report incidents through the Facebook page, and how do you handle that? And that has happened. I wanted to go back again and talk really fast about this mashup idea. A very interesting thing that happened during the Haiti earthquake is that there was a PhD in the University of Colorado who had proposed a way to do machine-readable hashtags on Twitter. And she had this whole, you know, system of hashtags that you can use, and then you can write a program that could read through the tweets and pull out requests for help and then kind of coordinate that with local services. And I thought that was a really neat idea. There's a lot of question about whether open data is sustainable because of concerns about privacy and accuracy and things like that. So that's an open question. And a lot of what I'm talking about in this talk about open data, particularly in New York City, is an ongoing conversation, and it's almost obsolete as soon as I talk about it because every day I get another article about new things that are going on. I don't know if we have time for the town hall meeting, but I am speaking down at the poster session. So if you want to talk about how we can work as a community or as individuals to help out, you know, and develop new services, systems, and things like that, come see me at the poster session. This is some information about me, and thank you very much. I hope you enjoy the rest of the conference.
I was wanting to comment about my experience as a deaf person. This was a very good presentation, but there was nothing about people with disabilities in the emergency process or emergency plan. I'm from New York City. I've been through 9/11. Through the blackouts. I was fortunate that I was at work and I had a coworker with me. I had someone there. So there are a lot of deaf and hard of hearing people there in New York City who were stuck in the subways, stuck in the dark, stuck in elevators with no knowledge, no way to get that. So if there's an emergency that happens, but there's no way, just information on how we can get information sharing to these people. Is the information auditory only? Is it auditory and printed or captions sent through text? Is it online, some other way than just auditory and through the voice?
There's a lot of text-based systems through RSS. The Notify New York is entirely text-based. And I also have some Ready New York guides here that are produced for people.
That's not been my experience. I was in the subway in New York. I take the subway a lot. And there was a change. The flashes were going on, and there was public notification audibly, but people were leaving, and they were going in a hurry. And so I missed the train. Many times something like that has happened. When I go into the subway before, if I could get an email that, you know, something happened, but by the time that I get out of the subway, I can't hear, and I would get that afterward. And so I have hearing friends They said it was hard to hear, that it wasn't clear, so they didn't understand also what would happen. So it's not only deaf and hearing people, but there's also people that are blind that might need some information as well. And the subway, if they have that printed, so that's the next stop, that something might happen. Or if you miss the stop, there's more information. You don't know if you're supposed to go upstairs or downstairs. And I went up, and I was supposed to be down, so I asked somebody else if I was going in the right direction. So that was just another idea. And I have a friend who's deaf from California that last month, during the earthquake, there was no information, no text information at all. So those people with disabilities, maybe they're in a wheelchair, stuck on a subway. And there's a lot of different things where people with disabilities that do need information that people with disabilities need, and considerations that are needed as well.
And I think that that would be one of the things that we can help to develop ideas around. One of the things, you talked about the subway system, and that has been a problem for the hearing for a very long time because the communication systems and intercom systems in the subway are not that good. The Office of Information Management has an interest in developing systems that allow communication into what they call deep infrastructure. So things like the subway, things like underneath the street, where we have, you know, Con Ed workers and things like that, and having more access to wireless services, cell phone and things like that. It's a problem for everyone. And they are looking for ideas in developing those areas. I could definitely bring, you know, that as a concern to the meeting. I'm actually going to be speaking at the Office of Information Management next week on Wednesday, so I can bring that as a concern.
I appreciate that. That would be appreciated. Thank you.
Thanks, everyone. Any other questions?
Thanks for listening to this podcast from the 2012 IA Summit. The IA Summit podcasts are sponsored by the UIE Virtual Seminar Program, with scores of online seminars your team can access on demand. For free access to a virtual seminar, visit uie.com/IAS12. And you can find the rest of the IA Summit podcasts at library.iasummit.org.